irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah. And in studio today with me is not Therapist Kelly, but a dear friend of mine who's also an author and a wonderful lady, Misty B. Hi, Misty.
Hi.
Tell me what's up with you these days.
Okay, well, what's up with me is I'm not a therapist, but I definitely can use the help of a therapist most of the time. I'm an author and filmmaker, and my most recent book, which was called If You Leave Me, Can I Come With You? Meditations for Codependents and Al-Anons with a Sense of Humor. And then prior to that, I wrote a book called Forgive Us Our Debts, Please. And my focus is on bringing recovery, humor back to recovery, especially with people who are more on the codependent side, which we tend to be a little kind of drags. So I'm trying to bring the humor back. So I'm glad to be here today.
Yes, and I could say they are both great books. So I'm glad that you're here too, and you're always so spunky, and you look great, and it's always good to see you, even
great.
If we
you
have
too.
To do it in this context. We just got to share lunch at Gelson's Salad Bar and take our entitled sample of free soup.
It was great.
Okay, so anyway, so Kelly couldn't be here today, but she's here in spirit, and I'll just give you a rundown of last week's show in case you missed it. We had Corey Greathouse Sloan, the founder and president of Life Uncommon, and she really worked with us. You would have been here great last week because she works with what really works in recovery.
Ah.
You know, how to help the families and really help the system after the treatment, you know, how to keep people really facing the life challenges in a way that is supportive and makes them have success. So it was a really good show. If you missed that, please go take a listen.
Okay. Okay. I will.
Okay.
Not right now, but I will.
Not right now? Okay. But today, we have a fabulous guest, Douglas Knoll, also known as Doug, who's a lawyer turned peacemaker. His calling is to serve humanity, and he executes his calling at many levels. Doug's work carries him into many dark places. Using pragmatic and practical skills of peace, he helps people resolve deep interpersonal and ideological conflicts. He is an award-winning author of 3 books, a teacher, speaker, and a trainer. His 4th book, De-Escalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less, is just been recently released, and we're going to talk up a storm about that. Welcome, Doug.
Hey, ladies, thanks for having me.
You are welcome. And can you hear us well now?
Yeah, you both are coming in very clear.
Yay! Okay, and also, audience, lovely audience, if anybody has a question or a comment, would like to give us a call, please do so at 323-203-0815. All right, we're just going to launch right in. So are you a practicing lawyer?
No, I'm an active member of the California State Bar, but I'm not practicing law anymore. I stopped doing that in November of 2000 when I became a peacemaker.
Okay. Tell us, what is a peacemaker?
Well, I mean, you summarized it in the introduction pretty well. I am called by people who have deep conflicts where typically it could be a litigated dispute or more often than not a non-litigated dispute where litigation is not going to help people. And I'm called in to help them solve problems that they cannot solve for themselves. And my process is basically to get people calmed down using the de-escalation skills that we'll talk about in a few minutes, and then engage them in a very thoughtful problem-solving process to help them understand their problem, understand their choices, and then understand the consequences of each choice so they can make a good decision about what they have in front of them. And oftentimes, realistically, people in deep conflict are faced with a series of a group of bad choices. And so part of what I do is help people pick and implement the least worst choice in front of them. And we do this in a way that preserves relationships as much as possible and also preserves wealth. So that's basically what I do. And I teach. I teach at Pepperdine, and I write, and, of course, go all over the world talking about my work.
Awesome. Misty, yeah, what do you want
to
say?
I went to Pepperdine, and I know that law school. I used to go there quite often because that's where all the cute boys were.
There you go. In fact, I'm going to be with Pepperdine in Nashville tomorrow.
Oh, great.
So
that's awesome. Yeah, so, and conflict, you know, can come in so many different varieties. There's people who have passive conflict, active conflict. Do you
just, absolutely.
Yeah. So what do you think is the kind of conflict that is the hardest to resolve? Is there any sort of specific conditions that make it really challenging?
Probably the most difficult conflicts are ones in which there are deep ideologies that are opposing each other. And where people's, that's number one. Number two is where we've got personality disorders involved, particularly the maladaptive, overt maladaptive narcissist. If we've got a person with that personality disorder involved in the mix, we're going to have problems. That's very challenging.
And just to define for our audience, a personality disorder does not mean one has a bad personality. It basically is a cluster of characteristics that somebody
Correct.
Holds very dear to their being, and they do not experience that there's any problem with their behavior. It's always the rest of the world that has a problem with them, but not that they themselves experience that's a problem. And they don't have any flexibility in changing their style of coping with the world because these things are rigidly encased in who they are. So they can be, I mean, most of us have encountered somebody with a personality disorder in our lives, in our intimate lives, and in our relationships, and they are a challenge.
Would you find that you're experiencing more of those types of personalities, Doug? Is it more more prevalent than it used to be?
No. I encounter conflicts where a personality disorder is at play very rarely.
Oh, great.
Of course, everybody in the conflict is quick to label and judge. Mm-hmm. But that's normal. But I really, really rarely find what I would consider to be a clinical level problem. Sometimes it happens. I'm sensitive to it. But it's not. I don't find it to be common. But when I do run into them, they're really challenging, very difficult.
And also, there are people who don't have a full fledged personality disorder, but they're sort of on the continuum. And when you're anytime you're working with somebody in the narcissistic realm, you're going to deal with somebody who's very entitled, who's very grandiose, who believes that they're more right and smarter and better than everyone else, and you can't criticize
and
them.
That happens fairly frequently, and I also find that conflict tends to make really nice people not so very nice.
Yes.
I'm seeing nice people at their worst. Mm. So whatever tendencies they tend to have that might be maladaptive are amplified by conflict, and so we have to work with that.
And what do? You just say, shut the fuck up?
I have been known to say that. No.
No.
Generally, as a peacemaker and mediator, that is
not
counterproductive.
Then I'd be good at that. That's a great career call.
Not my recommended advice to my students. Typically, if people are really escalated and emotional, and they are, they're not going to pay me the kind of fees that I get for doing this kind of work, especially in family business conflicts or partnership disputes or, where relationships are at stake, and usually there's a lot of wealth involved, and people can't afford, they can afford to bring in lawyers, but if they bring in lawyers, all their wealth is going to get dissipated in the legal system.
Right.
So they need other processes that are going to help them get through this. Typically, when I'm called in, there is a lot of anger and a lot of frustration, almost hatred, rage. And so my job is really to get people de-escalated, get them calmed down at a very deep level, so that we can engage in problem solving. And the worst mistake that people make is they try to engage angry people in problem solving first and completely ignore the emotional component of the conflict. And I've learned, and the research shows, that that's just a big mistake. You've got questions before you can deal with anything else.
Well, that makes sense because the central nervous system is completely activated in a state of anger, and our executive functioning, our ability to think clearly goes out the window. We're in survival mode. We think that we're being attacked. We think that we're being put in danger. Doug?
I think we lost him.
Did we lose you? All right, then. Let me call him right back. Okay. Entertain our audience
okay,
while I
so,
do that.
Here's what I know as the non-therapist that I am. Is this where the amygdala comes into play when we are... Okay, I'll probably answer my own question because Deborah's busy right now. I think this is where the limbic system goes crazy and people
yes.
go to fight or flight. And that seems really valuable to de-escalate that. I mean, I know in my own life when people are angry, I never really thought about de-escalating. I sort of thought about getting them to
agree with you?
Yeah, mostly. And they should because I'm usually right. But when I'm not, it's probably a good idea to try to de-escalate. Actually, I haven't read all of the book, but I've read pieces and parts, and I'm excited to ask Doug about a few things. One being he discusses work situations in which there's bullying or there is sabotage, and I think a lot of us, that's something that a lot of us have dealt with in the workplace, so that'll be interesting to get his feedback on that.
Well, and hopefully he's going to answer this other call.
Okay.
All
right. Well, I'll just keep talking.
Why don't you tell us a story about when once you have been completely enraged?
Let's see.
Yesterday?
Oh, boy. It'll be good. No,
five
not yesterday. It's
ago?
Been. It's been in about 5 minutes I will be if Doug doesn't come back.
Doug, where are you?
Well, let's see. You know, I've been known to have in my own life some road rage, which I think... seems to be becoming more common, but I mean, I actually, it's kind of strange confession since I'm sort of talking to myself.
No, I'm talking
to you.
Because our technician here, Mr. Sam, is here, and he's going to help us.
Okay, so you'll love this. I actually put myself in anger management at one point.
Like your own timeout?
Yeah, my own. No, I actually hired someone to help me figure out anger.
Oh, you did tell me that
once.
That is hysterical.
Well, when I found myself getting... in a situation where a guy had cut me off and then he kept following me and then I literally got out of the car and was like screaming at him, I went, this is a problem. So I sentenced myself to anger management and I found a guy locally. He sat down with me and he said, okay, well, where's your court order? And I said, what court order? And he said,
that's right,
don't you have
people go to anger management because they've been court ordered.
He said, don't you have something for me to sign? And I said, no, I sent myself here. And he goes, oh my God, I've never met a person in my life who sends himself to anger management. But I knew that there was a point, there was a lot of triggers, a lot of things going in my life that had made me really angry. And I did not know how to deal with it in a way that was going to, I think, I just didn't know. I didn't think I had the tools. So I worked with him probably about 5 or 6 times. And then I think I got to a point where things had changed situationally. So sometimes the rage is situational.
Well, it's displacement a lot of times, right? There's something else that's going on in your life that's really troubling, over which you have maybe zero or no control, and that's bothersome to the human spirit to think that we're sort of totally powerless over some situation or a person.
Mm-hmm.
It's true most of the time that we are, but we get frustrated by that, and then there's a ripe and ready experience right in front of you where it feels like it's an acceptable moment to discharge that anger. I think that's really what road rage comes down to.
Well, what he told me was that, you know, we feel like we have a sense of control when we're in a car. And that's why I think we see a lot more of it. People feel really out of control right now in this climate. And when we're behind a car, we feel like, you know, like for me, and I'll just be honest, I find that males in the car tend to be, huge generalization, but they tend to be more aggressive when they drive. And when you're a woman, I've noticed that they feel like it's okay to kind of ride up on you. And that's one of those things that drives me nuts when somebody rides my ass, in the car. And it just seems like that's one where I can kind of get back.
Right.
So I used to flip the bird. I used to honk. And then, you know, I don't find those situations happening as much. But I did feel like he gave me some tools to handle it so that I was able to, you know, really kind of take... He gave me little squeeze balls, actually. Those were kind of cool. He gave me squeeze balls to take in the car.
Oh, I love those. Those are great. Yeah.
I don't use them, but it's nice to have them. But it was really helpful to have someone, you know, kind of talk to me through it. And,
right.
and he seemed to be very empathic. He understood
That's
where
nice.
I was coming from.
Right. Because we've all been there, right? Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to disclose one of my total... hypocritical experiences, right?
Yay.
So I love to mouth off to other drivers in the car.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just say silly things like, you dumbass. You know, I'm really actually in a state of anger. Mm-hmm. I'm usually just, it's like, it's just fun to mm-hmm. emote that way. Mm-hmm. But when Chris does it, and I'm in the car or I'm on the phone with him, I'm like, why are you getting so pissed off? Why are you doing this? And I will like, you know, and then that's intimidating. When I do it, it's not intimidating because I know that I'm not angry and I'm not going to accelerate on the gas pedal or anything. Mm-hmm. But I know that I see a lot of people that are like that. You know, we just mm-hmm. want to kind of emote. It's mm-hmm. not really that we want to do something mm-hmm. to the other person, but it's mm-hmm. a good cathartic experience. But I definitely have a double standard on that one.
Oh, good. So you're like a human being.
Of course.
Because I'm super hypocritical. All the time about everything. Not really. But I think...
Let's share some of our own experiences of either de-escalating ourselves or helping somebody else to de-escalate. Now, I've had to do that in my business. It's interesting that, you know, Doug would say that, no, it's not okay to say shut the fuck up when somebody's escalated. And he probably wouldn't because that's not going to be his orientation to that. But I actually literally had someone in my office the other day, and it was a family situation, mm-hmm. and one of the clients was getting really stirred up inappropriately, and I literally looked at him and I said, you need to stop now.
Okay.
Stop it. And he looked at me and he was shocked because I don't talk to him that way, but it was effective. Mm-hmm. What was effective was he stopped and he mm-hmm. paused, and he knows he totally respects me, and I'm very mm-hmm. compassionate toward him. And he said, you're right. He calmed down, we took a break, started up again, and he stayed reasonably calm for the rest of the time.
Hmm.
I was like, wow, that's impressive. It could have gone either way. He could have mm-hmm. picked up a firearm and shot me. I mean, which has happened to therapists before.
Wow.
Yeah.
You'll tell me about that off.
Somebody in, one therapist in my building in Encino, actually, years ago, it was a couple. Apparently the husband was really pissed off at the wife, went downstairs, got a gun, came back up, shot the therapist, and shot the wife.
Good Lord.
Good Lord, right?
What were they doing while he went downstairs? Didn't they think there's a problem here?
Sometimes people leave a session because they want to go calm down. They want to go take a break, or they mm-hmm. can't handle it anymore. They say, you know, I just can't handle it anymore. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, I encourage you to come back if mm-hmm. you are able. You know, we'll be mm-hmm. we'll be here, and we'll just continue processing mm-hmm. in the session. And a lot of times people will come back. They will mm-hmm. have gone out and taken a walk, take a smoke break, mm-hmm. you know, get a cup of water.
Shoot a couple people before they come back.
Yes,
that's good. Get that out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think, I know for me, it's easier to emote on people that I don't know. So I'll mm-hmm. hold it in with the people that are in my life, and then in the car, it's like, phew, you know, because I don't know them. I'll never see them again. What I'm learning is that's not really a good way to approach life. Mm-hmm. But I've learned some tools in my own personal recovery that help. And they're kind of, like when I first heard them, I thought they were really corny, but they actually work. I don't know if this would be considered de-escalation, but when someone's saying something that I don't agree with that I know could maybe get me triggered, if you mm-hmm. will, I'll say something like, you know, you could be right. Mm-hmm. You could be right. Or...
That's an interesting point of view.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'll take that into consideration. Mm-hmm. I won't. But I'll take that into consideration. But I said that to them. I have an example.
But this is to keep you calm,
yes.
or this is to help the other person also not get incited by maybe a disagreement or, you know, a difference of opinion? I think it's both.
Yeah. I don't know. It just seems, it's not always, I'm not always cognizant of what I'm doing,
right.
why I'm doing it. Sometimes it becomes just... I'm trying to... I don't know that I use the word de-escalate, which is why this is an exciting
right.
topic, because when you're more aware of what it is you're doing
sure.
versus just kind of trying to... I think it probably is more about keeping myself. So I'm probably like a good...
But it has a bonus, I think.
Yeah.
I think with the bonus pack is it does also help somebody see you not being contentious
yes.
or having to drive your point home, but
yes.
making room for it. It's a variation of indirect empathy, because you're basically saying, mm. oh, I can see mm-hmm. that you are seeing something or thinking something different than me, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make room for that in this room, in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very helpful. Most people get more grounded and calm down mm-hmm. when they're not as... agitated because they fear that they're going to be either, you know, pushed over mm-hmm. or right.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear more about this, because I've seen situations where someone's getting amped up. I'll tell you, like in a Starbucks or something, and you see someone, and I've been this person. And generally for me, you know, watching this, I'll see someone get escalated and angry, and then the other person will be super calm. And sometimes I find when someone's super duper calm, it makes it worse.
Well, it's more agitating.
Yeah,
right?
Like, so if you're
like,
screaming,
how the hell can you be so calm? Oh, that pisses me off.
When you're screaming at me and they're like, I'm okay. So sorry. What can I do for you? It's like you want to go, don't effing patronize me. So I think that there's something in between that says, look, I acknowledge what you're saying. I've had people say to me, look, I acknowledge that you're upset. So on the phone, that's an example for me. It's been, God, I think I'm his subject. I think I'm his client. But, you know, where you get irritated about Time Warner, you didn't show up, or you're overcharging me, and I don't, you know, and then the person will say, I really hear you. I understand. And let's see how we can work that out. That's fantastic. That's de-escalation. What's not de-escalation is, are you anything else you'd like to say? Or like a condescending, or that, like you said, it's agitation. Just irritating. It's
well,
not.
Yeah, because you don't really feel like you're even being heard. It's kind of like dismissing you as not even being a legitimate human being in the room. But I mean, we've all been there. I've certainly, you know, when somebody has pushed my buttons to a certain degree where I just don't feel safe anymore, I will get like doubly as angry as that person, which is terrible. It's terrible for me. It's terrible for the situation. And it's terrible for that person. But that usually is when we're in a state of complete sense of utter powerlessness, because rage primarily is anger coupled with helplessness or powerlessness. So
it's interesting, because if there are situations in a person's life where there's just a lot that they're not in control of, I mean, part of my personal recovery is that the viewpoint that there's very little I can't control other people. I can't control things or places or viewpoints. I can control myself.
But you can try, right?
Oh, I do. Every day, all day long, it's half my brain is, how can I fix this person? But, you know, when you feel that there's a lot of situations in your life that you don't have power over or control over, and rage kind of gets hold, de-escalating that, or learning to, I think it's learning to de-escalate your own self too. So
absolutely.
Maybe it's learning how to apply this in the real world as viewers or listeners coming from the opposite side of like, how do I do this for myself in my own life?
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting. You talk about controlling other people, but while we can't control other people by and large, unless it's a little 3-year-old and we can literally pick them up and put them in the car seat, basically, though, we do have influence over other people. And I think when we learn to sort of hone in on our ability to be heard in a way that our listener can receive the information, then we can be far more influential and persuasive in our communications with people. Now, we have another techno person here with us trying to say that. Okay, so we're going to take a short break.
Bye. We're going to de-escalate this.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Doug?
Hello?
Hello, great. Okay, yes, I think we can hear him.
Good.
We got our guest back. Woohoo! All right. You got to love technology, the crazy world in which we live right now.
All I can do is laugh.
Well, I don't know that you were able to hear any of that from a podcast. Probably not, but Misty and I have been having a hell of a lot of fun talking about escalating, de-escalating ourselves and others.
Well, good.
So now, what's that? Hello? Oh, no.
I'm here.
Okay, good. I'm like, I'm going to start getting escalated.
And I'm going to have to learn how to calm you down,
That's
and
right.
I don't.
I'm really frustrated.
Okay. All right. I think we're in good shape now. All right. Awesome.
Okay.
So, okay, I'm getting special instructions on how to hold the phone also. Okay.
Okay.
Yes, great. Okay. All right. So,
I'm good.
Let's just dive into what we're really dying to know is what is the 90 seconds or less technique that you use to get somebody to calm down?
All right. First of all, what I need you to do is grab a pencil and paper.
Yep.
And write down these three steps because there's going to be a quiz afterwards.
I love it.
Ooh.
Go.
I'm a law professor. I can't help myself.
Okay.
All right. Step number one. Let's just assume for the moment you're confronting somebody who's very angry.
Okay.
Doesn't matter their age. 2 years old, 90 years old, doesn't matter. Step number one, ignore the words. You've heard angry people before a million times. You don't need to listen to this stuff. You know what they're saying. So ignore it. It's just noise. For the next 90 seconds, ignore the words. Consciously ignore the words. It's like, just not important what they're saying.
Like thinking of something else or literally saying what you just said?
Nope.
Just not...
You're going to be... I'm just ignore the words. You're going to be doing something else.
Got it.
And the reason I want you to ignore the words is you're going to be using your brain power to do something very different, which is step number two. But first, you have to consciously say, all I hear right now is noise. It means nothing to me.
So should we think of like puppies or
two.
Something sweet like that?
He's going to tell us.
You don't have to think about that. Just this is just noise.
Okay.
I'm not paying any attention to this. It's like a train going by.
Okay.
Step number two, we're going to guess at what we think this angry person's emotions are. It's going to be obvious that anger is there, but there's always stuff underneath anger.
Yes.
Shame, humiliation, sadness, grief, loss of support, not being heard, not being listened to, feeling like they're being treated unfairly, abandonment, fear, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Guess at what you think this person's emotional experience is. Step number three, and this is the counterintuitive secret sauce. Tell the person in a direct you statement what they're feeling. You're angry. You're frustrated. You're sad. You're anxious. You don't feel like you're being listened to. You feel like you've been treated unfairly. You're unhappy. Whatever the emotions are, tell them what they're feeling. It's a reflection. You're reflecting back what they're feeling, telling them what they're feeling with a very simple you statement. No I statements, no questions.
Hmm.
Those don't work. They never have. They never will. So you and yeah, no, there's no science to support any of that stuff. There's hard science to support what I'm talking about.
Wow.
That's the difference.
But what if you're wrong? what if you're wrong
good.
With what if you say?
Okay, yeah, no, that's a great question.
Yeah.
Supposing I say, oh, you're really angry. You say, no, I'm not angry. I'm frustrated.
Hmm. Uh-huh.
And I say, great, you're really frustrated. I say, great to myself. And I say, oh, you're really frustrated. I just come back with a correction.
Got it.
And the speaker loves it. It's beautiful.
Right.
You're never wrong.
Got
you
it.
You are never wrong. That's the beauty of this. One of the many beauties. One of the great. So you do this. Just all you're doing is reflecting emotions, not saying anything else. You're just reflecting back, telling them what they're feeling. You do this. Until you get four involuntary responses that you're looking for. They're involuntary and unconscious. So the speaker doesn't even know that the speaker is doing it, but you're watching for it. You're watching for a nod of the head, up and down, affirmative. You're looking for a verbal response like, yeah, or exactly, or uh-huh, yeah, right. Something like that. Usually very
you got
inflammatory.
It, asshole.
Yeah, I'm going to punch you now.
Exactly correct. Exactly correct. You'll get something like that. You'll get a dropping of the shoulders. And you'll get a big sigh of relief. When you see those four things, you're done.
Huh.
You've de-escalated. Takes about 45 seconds. Now, if you go for 90 seconds and you're not getting anywhere, my recommendation is you back off a little bit and try it again later. Something else is going on.
Mm. Okay.
What would be going on?
Well, it could be that it could be really deep-seated emotions that you're not able to penetrate right now. It could be you're in the wrong context.
Okay.
Could be you're not subtle enough. Could be that, you know, I don't see it happen very often, but it occasionally it does happen. Not very often. This works about 98% of the time. So there's 2% of the time it's, you know, it's not going to work first time, but it works. It's pretty rock solid in how it works. So the two big things that are going to happen is, one, either you're not going to get a reaction, something's going to go wrong, usually because you were not subtle enough in the way that you reflected back the emotions. That's the biggest problem. And when you are not subtle enough, either you're not going to be able to get the de-escalation that you're looking for, or somebody's going to push back and say, who the hell do you think you are, my therapist?
I can see
that. Yeah. No, I'm your peacemaker. So when you do that, that's always an indicator to me that I was not subtle enough.
So you try again.
And so it was too much in their face. So I got to back off a little bit. So what I tell people to do then is back off for 5 minutes and come back and do it again. Only be more subtle.
Okay. And subtle, by subtle, you mean something softer, right? Like, you're really
softer,
angry right
more
now.
Conversational.
Instead of, you're an angry mother.
Exactly. You got it exactly. I mean, maybe you came across with too much intensity. Maybe it was a little too mechanical, not relaxed enough. So you got to just, this comes with practice. For me today, I've been doing this for so long, it's just normal for me. So I rarely get pushback. I do, you know, one out of 1,000 people will push me back. And I just back off, and 5 minutes later I get them, and I got them calmed down. Not a big deal.
There's a beautiful key to this I'm hearing. I don't know that you're speaking to it directly, but for me, from therapist language, when we are not personalizing something and recognizing it's someone else's emotion that's within them, then it's so much easier to be compassionate and empathetic towards someone, which that may be part of the undercurrent in
that's
the subtlety,
exactly,
right?
That's correct. And there are huge benefits for us as listeners in doing this. The first benefit is that when we ignore the words and focus on the emotions, it's as if a shield is coming up. Nothing that person can say to us is going to get into us and bother us. That's the first thing. Second thing that happens is, we know from brain scanning studies that when we start focusing on another person's emotions, the part of our prefrontal cortex, one part deactivates and the other part activates. And what's interesting is the part of our prefrontal cortex that deactivates is what we experience as ego. That stops. We move into the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is the upper part of the prefrontal cortex. That's our higher self. And we experience a transcendence experience where we are egoless and we kind of feel transcendent and one with this person.
I also think that there's
really
something. I'm sorry. I think there's something about people like to hear about themselves. So you're feeling this, and that's why maybe the I statements.
Well, what's happening
successful.
Is you're validating their feelings. But the key here is what are the benefits to the listener for doing this? Not only are you calming somebody down, but you're protecting yourself. You're moving into an egoless, transcendent state, and third, you're reprogramming your own brain, so that you will be in a couple of weeks of practice, you will be able to de-escalate yourself just as effortlessly as you de-escalate somebody else.
I have so many questions.
I mean, it's powerful.
Gosh, I have so many questions.
Powerful.
So, question. If the person you're dealing with isn't outwardly angry, but it's more of a passive-aggressive anger, how does something like this work? Say in mediation, maybe the person's saying all the right words, but beneath it is a lot of anger and a lot of...
So I sense that. I sense that, and I tell them what they're feeling. I affect label them, and usually people like that will be reduced to sobs in about 45 seconds, because it's the first time anybody's taken the time to really listen to them deeply.
Okay.
So can you give an example of how you would say that to someone?
Sure. Tell me a story, Misty. Give me a story of something that's happened to you in the last day or two that has a little bit of emotional component to it, and I'll just show you how it's done.
Can I give
it takes
you
about
something?
30 seconds?
Okay. Can I give you something that's a month old, or does it have to be in the
whatever you want?
Okay. I was working for a company where the boss was a bully, and he would constantly pull people in the office and berate them for literally like 20 minutes, and he had this way about him, Misty. What are you doing all day? I'd like to see what you're working on. And then it would be, well, what are you doing? Why are you wasting all this time? You know, he'd start screaming and yelling. And I thought I was doing the right thing by saying things like, you know, I understand that you want this work done. I do need some time to get it completed. So I thought I was doing it right, but obviously I wasn't, because he just kept screaming.
Because you got canned.
Because I got canned. Because I finally just said, you can't talk to me this way.
So Misty, let's just reflect on what's happened here. You felt extremely disrespected.
Mm-hmm.
And you were very frustrated and very anxious because you wanted to do a good job. You felt unappreciated and unsupported.
Mm-hmm.
And you felt confused because you were given instructions that seemed to be at cross purposes with what you thought you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you ultimately became angry. You were angry because all of this stuff was unjustified and unfair. And it was deeply disrespectful.
Now, how, though, could she have helped her boss de-escalate?
Mm-hmm.
So then let's take the boss. So Misty talks to the boss and says, Mr. Jones, you're really angry. You're really frustrated. You don't feel like anybody's supporting you. You don't feel like you've got any control, and you've got a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear, and you're really unhappy with how things are going. And just wait and see what he does. And he might correct. He might say, well, I'm not really not frustrated. I am angry. Nobody supports me. I got to constantly look over everybody's shoulders. And then you repeat that back. You say, So you're really frustrated because you're betrayed all the time. Your workers betray you. No one does what they say they're going to do. And it really is frustrating to you. And you feel really sad and a little lonely because you're all by yourself here and can't depend on anybody else.
So I like this, and another part of me says, whoa, as an employee, I would feel really nervous about talking to a boss that way, fearing that it could lead to a sense of being insubordination or something like that. I mean, do you find that that is an appropriate style for an employee to take?
I find just the opposite.
Really?
People who have done this in workplaces, especially with boss bullies, found that they all of a sudden got into most favored employee status and were quickly promoted. They became indispensable.
Wow.
Okay, we'll get you back hired there, Misty, and you're going to do an experiment.
I don't really want to work with bullies anymore. But
because why do bullies bully, whether they're bosses or 12-year-olds? Because they are dealing with their own anxieties. They're dealing with their own low self-esteem. They're dealing with their own inadequacies. You're validating them at a very deep level. You're soothing them at a very deep level. They don't know what's going on. One part of their brain just knows that something is happening that's very powerful and good.
Okay.
And they want more of that. So they're gonna keep you around.
Okay.
If you do what Missy started to do, which is, hey, wait a minute, you told me to do this, now you're telling me to do this, and I really need clear instructions. You're trying to problem solve before you've de-escalated.
You
do when you problem solve before you de-escalate is you could piss people off even more.
Ah, that's good. So I went into problem solving before I brought this.
You went into problem solving way, way too early.
Okay.
You cannot solve an emotional problem with logic.
Ah.
You can't.
True.
You have to address the emotions first, then you problem solve.
Okay. I like that.
Yeah, this is doable.
And this is the mistake that so many people make. Therapists make this mistake. Lawyers make this mistake. They're confronted with angry, upset people, and they immediately go into problem solving rather than addressing the emotional stuff first and getting people calmed down and de-escalated. Mm-hmm. And when you problem solve too early, you're doing that to soothe your own anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you are not validating the other person. You're invalidating their emotions. You're ignoring their emotions.
Mm.
It's extremely abusive when you do that. Extremely abusive. Especially when you do it with kids.
But not,
horrible for
not
kids.
An employee to a boss. That's not being abusive. If the boss is being abusive.
Well, if the employee is... Yeah, it is. It's emotionally abusive to any human being. Doesn't matter what the hierarchy role is.
Hmm.
If an employee is trying to problem solve without de-escalating, that's abuse to the boss's emotions.
Hmm.
Now it's a weird deal because there's a hierarchical role difference,
mm-hmm.
and potentially a power difference, but it doesn't take away the humanity of it all.
Well, that's true. This brings a whole new perspective on what I think.
That's right. It's a radical
shift.
That's right. It's a radical different way of looking at human nature and who we are as human beings. And it puts primacy over our emotions and the fact that we are 100% emotional and 0% rational, which is true. We have only what's known as bounded rationality. nothing like what Western culture and philosophy have been trying to brainwash us into believing for the last 3,000 years. All wrong. Neuroscience is proving that. We are 100% emotional with very limited, small amounts of rationality. And we can't even be rational until we're emotional first. You could never be rational unless you have emotions. Because how would you know when to use rational problem solving until you have an emotion around something that tells you that there's a problem to be solved?
I see.
It's emotions that tell us we have problems.
Mm.
So this whole myth of Spock and Star Trek, I mean, Roddenberry was a genius. I write about this in the book. He was a genius in many ways. But people have taken the Spockian idea of rationality and held it up as being, this is the ideal. No, that's clinical insanity.
Okay, well, I'm speechless.
Emotionality is what makes us human. It's not what rationality does not make us different from other animals. It's our emotions that make us different from other animals.
Ooh,
no other species on the planet has emotions like humans. None, not even the primates.
The complexity of our emotions.
Emotions create social reality. Emotions create culture. Emotions create relationship. Without emotions, we are not human.
All right.
So we better start paying attention to them.
Okay, so
and this is where the psychologists and the psychiatrists are at war with the neuroscientists.
Hmm.
Because the neuroscientists are saying, this is what science is telling us. We have studied the brain. We can scan the brain. We see what's going on. And you guys have got to get on board. Freud was wrong. He was dead. He was a genius. But he's a wrong genius. Totally wrong. Skinner was wrong. You know, these people were all wrong in their guesses and their theories about what it means to be human and how the brain processes information. It's only neuroscience. In the last 10 years has really begun to get a glimmer of what this is all about. And it's not what psychology and psychiatry are based on. It's based on a completely different theory, and evidence of what the human brain is all about.
Do you get any pushback from therapists and psychiatrists with this viewpoint?
No. What's amazing is when I teach these skills to therapists and psychologists, they say, how come I wasn't taught this 40 years ago?
Wow.
Mm. Well, I'm completely humbled.
And I'm saying, well, the reason is that it didn't exist 40 years ago. This is all brand new stuff.
So where did you learn
this?
But
what we have to do is we have to engage in reading and studying to understand what science is telling us today about what we know. And what we know is very different than what we were taught.
So your your experience with this, how did you discover? Is this your discovery or is it just research?
Yeah. I had a mediation in 2004 in Santa Barbara. And I'll try to keep the story brief. A couple have been divorced. While they were married, they had been involved in a small automobile accident. There was a small insurance settlement for the kids who were minors at the time. The money was put into what's called a minor's trust in California. And that means the parents can't take the money and run off to Las Vegas and gamble it away. They can't take the money out unless they get a court order. Well, of course, the ex-husband was a deadbeat, didn't pay any support. Mom fell on hard times. Kids are now adults. She calls the kids and say, hey, we got this $18,000. Do you guys mind if I take this to pay rent and buy groceries? And they say, Mom, take the money. We don't care. So she takes the money. She does not get a court order. Husband sues her for breach of trust, violation of fiduciary duty. They spend $50,000 in attorney's fees, and they finally come to me. I get them in the room, sit them down. They're facing each other. I'm at the head of the table, and they're not even sitting down before. They're screaming at each other, cussing each other out, vile language. And suddenly the thought came to me, listen to the emotions. I don't know where this came from. It just came to me. And so I told Susan, all I want you to do is to listen to John, and instead of listening to his words, ignore them and pay attention only to what he's feeling and tell us what you think he's feeling. So she struggled with that for a bit, and I kept coaching her and coaching her. Finally, she got it. And then I had John do the same thing. Susan told her story. I had John ignore her words, focus on her emotions. And after about 20 minutes, they were finished. John put his head in his hands and started sobbing. And finally, he got composed himself and looked up at her with tears streaming down. It's not coming out of his nose. And he looked at her and said, that's the first time you've listened to me in 25 years.
Whoa.
And they settled the case 5 minutes after that.
Wow. Did they pay you a bonus?
Yeah, exactly. Wow. I walked out and said, what the hell is this all about? So then, 3 years later, I ran across Lieberman's study. And Matthew Lieberman, who was at UCLA, I understand he's now at Harvard, and he had done the scanning study on this thing that I just stumbled on called affect labeling, and showed what happens in the brain when we affect label somebody who's highly emotional, and showed why it works and how it works. And I read the study, and I said, holy crap, that's what happened in 2004. There's something really powerful here. And so then I began to develop the skills. And then in 2009, with my colleague Laurel Copper, we had the opportunity to go into prison, maximum security prisons in California, and teach murderers how to be peacemakers. Wow. So we taught this as our first foundational skill. And we've watched 30 inmates change the culture of a 4,000 inmate prison in a year using these skills.
Wow.
I mean, the transformations I've seen in the prisons are just unbelievable. Unbelievable. We had a call with the warden at Corcoran about a month ago. He said, what are you guys teaching that where our inmates don't want to leave? They don't want to leave until they're done with your training. What are you guys doing? Never heard that before.
Are the inmates open to it when you first come in?
Yeah, because inmates were saying, don't move me out of here until I've done this training. It's powerful. And that's what led to the book.
Yeah, Misty, you had a question?
How do the inmates receive that in the beginning? Are they open to it, or do you have to pry?
You know, like any other set of human beings, it ranges from totally open to totally skeptical. And people come in for a whole bunch of different motivations. So the project is called Prison of Peace, and if people are interested in it, they can go to the website, prisonofpeace.org, and learn about what we're doing. Some people think it's some big Christian thing, and so we get these people who are totally into their faith and come in, and they quickly learn we're very secular, you know. I mean, and an old white guy, a couple of lawyers, and, you know, an old white guy and a midlife Jewish woman teaching this stuff. And it's interesting. Some people we get in hate us. They come in and they say, I hate your class. I hate what you're teaching, but I cannot stay out. I cannot not be here.
Wow.
And then those people turn out to be very powerful peacemakers and mediators.
Amazing. Well, Doug, you will not believe it, but we are out of time, and we have been talking to Douglas Knoll with his book, Deescalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. How can people find the book? How can people find you? Thanks for mentioning the prison.
I got a deal for people. If you pay the shipping, I'll buy the book on Amazon for you.
Wow.
So you go to my website, DougKnoll.com, DougKnoll, pay the $7 for the shipping.
All right.
And I'll buy the book for $11 on Amazon, and Amazon will ship it to you, and you have it a couple of days. So just go to DougKnoll.com, click on the banner, go to the order page, and take it from there. How's that for a deal?
Well, I'm going to do it.
No author guest has ever given such a sweet and generous offer to our listeners.
This is how much I feel. This is how powerful I feel about this work. I want every human being on the planet to read this book, study it, practice it, and teach it.
What a vision.
Because we can't expect our leaders. Our leaders have created a culture of fear and tribalism because it's in their best interest to do so. And if we're disgusted with that, then we need to do the work ourselves in our own communities and families. So I want this book out there.
And that's other show. So
I know. We wanted to get to so much. We didn't.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you. You've been awesome. So articulate. So informative.
Thank you.
I'm going to walk out with a different perspective today and a good handful of tools. But we didn't get to take our test. What was our quiz?
What are the three steps that it takes to de-escalate somebody?
Okay. First, you just have to ignore the story. Pay attention to what the emotions are. Guess the emotions and tell the person in a direct use statement subtly what they're feeling.
And if that doesn't work, you try it again.
Right. Okay.
That's right. Gold star for the day. You got it.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you so much.
All right, ladies. Thank you.
Take care.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. All righty. That was so exciting. So, so, so exciting.
Wow. I was
stunned.
I never have nothing to say. I have nothing to say.
That was really fascinating stuff. I am so excited to learn more about that. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. We're always so grateful that you do. Please, next week, we have a guest who's going to be on the Museum of Broken Relationships. Please Instagram us at Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly. And Misty B., what's the name of your book again? People go take a look.
It's called If You Leave Me, Can I Come With You? Daily Humor for Al-Anons and Codependents.
Okay, Misty, thanks for being a great co-host.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.